Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to NASA's 50th birthday party. And it actually happened yesterday. Yesterday, July the 29th, was NASA's 50th anniversary. And I have brought along some of my friends to help us discuss what NASA has been doing all these years. And we're going to focus on manned spaceflight. Tom Pobrezny asked us to focus on manned spaceflight and everywhere that we have gone with all of our rockets from the beginning of NASA, which, as I just mentioned, started 50 years ago. First person I'd like to introduce, it is a real pleasure to welcome Apollo 15 astronaut who went to the moon, Al Warden.
Fantastic. Thank you, Hoot.
Well, it's great to have you here, and
I
think we're going to get to cover a whole lot of ground, and so it's wonderful for you to drop everything you were doing and join us tonight for this.
Well, it's always a pleasure coming back, and I'm glad to be back, and hi, everybody. I hope everyone's having a good night. It's NASA's 50th anniversary, but I also have to tell you there's another little anniversary going on tonight. 37 years ago, exactly now, I was going into lunar orbit. So wow. This is kind of a special night for me, too.
This is a special day. Thank you, Al. Okay, the next person I'd like to introduce, a veteran of four space shuttle flights, Mission Commander Steve Nagel.
Great.
Steve, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Hoot. Good to be here.
Fantastic. All right, next person. A veteran of four space shuttle flights and numerous spacewalks, extravehicular activities, happens to be Steve's wife, Linda Godwin. Linda, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Okay, rounding it out, we have one more astronaut, a veteran of four space shuttle flights, Mission Commander, former Chief Astronaut, Charlie Precourt.
Thank you, Hoot. I just realized I get to be a rookie again tonight, being the young guy on the line.
Yeah, how about this? You're the one introduced last, and you were the Chief Astronaut at NASA and a veteran of four space shuttle flights, two times to the Mir space station. So, yeah, you were...
Time flies.
In this group, I guess you're the rookie, but you're certainly no rookie at all. Have we got our slides working yet, is what I'm wondering. We're going to talk about 50 years of NASA, and the actual date, the anniversary date, was yesterday, and I'm looking for our slides. Okay, I guess we have them. Okay. All right, we have slides. They are up. Okay. NASA started out... 50 years ago yesterday, July the 29th was 1958, was the day that the Space Act was signed by President Eisenhower.
Wow.
That established NASA as a civilian agency to monitor and direct all spaceflight in the U.S. And in very short order, we had selected, I guess we're not going to be able to see our slides, are we? In very short order, we had selected the first seven astronauts. And are those showing up somewhere out on the stage, Mike?
Not yet.
Can you see slides out there somewhere? Okay, great.
Oh, they're up there.
In very short order, and Al was there very shortly after all this happened, we selected our first Mercury astronauts, the Mercury 7, all of whom were jet fighter pilots, jet test pilots, and off we went with the Mercury program. So where were we going with this?
Okay, let me just say a couple of words first. The seven Mercury guys were the pioneers, but I want to carry it one step further. I remember back, my grandmother was born before the turn of the century, and she was born in northern Michigan, where they had no amenities, no electricity, no telephone, no inside plumbing, and she saw Apollo 11 land on the moon. I think that's pretty miraculous that in 70 or 80 years we were able to do all of that. Actually, we did it in the period of about 10 years. The Mercury guys were selected back in the late 50s. All of them were either test pilots or good physical specimens. And they did something that nobody had ever done before, except for Yuri Gagarin, but we launched them into space. I have to tell you that the Mercury Gemini Apollo program was basically a flight test program and one thing built on another. When we first flew Al Shepard in space and then John Glenn went into Earth orbit, we didn't know whether we could send somebody into space and they could and bring them back and they could survive. We really didn't know back then if we could survive going into space. So Mercury was really a test program to ensure that we could go into space and spend some considerable time there. I think Gordon Cooper went for 7 days, that we could survive all of that. And that was the whole purpose of the Mercury program. Then the Gemini program came
along. Let's rattle through. I've got some Mercury slides here.
And let's take a look at the Mercury slides.
So we have the Project Mercury. We had six missions on Mercury.
Right.
Leading up to the seven-day mission with Gordon Cooper. And here's what our Mercury rocket looked like.
Well, if anybody's been to the Cape and they've seen the Redstone, they'll know that thing is just nothing but a Roman candle. And it only went 75 miles high,
and it was a pretty humble rocket and a pretty humble spacecraft.
It was pretty basic. It contained about 45 cubic feet of volume for one guy. That's pretty small space.
That's pretty small. We flew two suborbital flights with the Mercury program, and then after that, it was on to. And this is Alan Shepard being winched back up into the helicopter.
He spent 15 minutes. It's about the same as Spaceship One.
Yeah, exactly.
And now about we're doing it commercially, what he did for the first time back in 1961.
May the 5th of 1961 was when Alan Shepard went.
Right.
After that, Gus Grissom did a suborbital flight. And next it was on to a very important thing. 20 days after the very first space flight by an American, President Kennedy gave us the direction of landing on the moon by the end of the decade. And that's what really started the space program booming.
That's correct. He sensed the pulse of the country. He sensed the political and military significance of somebody else getting there first. And I think he put all that together, and he committed us to landing a man on the moon in 10 years and bringing him back safely. Of course, that's always the part we liked.
That's the part we really wanted some emphasis on.
We really thought that bringing back safely was really kind of nice.
We thought that was a real good idea. All right, so let's see. I wanted to show one more picture.
Okay, then we get into Gemini.
I'm in trouble with this thing. Okay, after the first two suborbital flights, somehow our slides are getting ahead of us.
Okay, that's okay.
We moved on to Project Gemini.
We did the two suborbitals, then John Glenn did the orbital thing. And we built up our time and space until Gordon did the seven-day flight. Then we moved into Gemini. Now, Gemini's getting closer to what we wanted to do when we were going to go to the moon. Gemini program was really designed to develop, demonstrate, and perfect the techniques that we would have if we're going to land a man on the moon and bring him back. And those things were, one, long-term space flight. We're thinking in those days in terms of 14 days. We had to be able to do rendezvous and docking, which we'd never done before. So that was a consideration. And the third thing was to do spacewalks or extravehicular activities. Because if you get into lunar orbit after the landing and you can't dock, then there's only one way to get over to the command module, and that's to go outside. So those three things were very critical to the Gemini program, and that's basically what the Gemini program proved.
Okay, and we flew 11 Gemini flights.
Right.
Culminating in one of them was a 14-day mission.
Right.
With
Frank
Borman. And Jim Lovell.
And Jim Lovell.
On the 14-day mission, we did the first orbital rendezvous anyone had done.
That's correct.
With Gemini 7 and Gemini 6 Alpha. Did the first orbital docking, which was Neil Armstrong, I think, on Gemini 8.
Well, yeah, Gemini 8 was the first docking. They had a little problem with that.
They had a little problem.
Had just a little problem. They had an RCS engine that fired and kind of started them spinning, and I think it took them a little while to get that under control. And as a matter of fact, once they got it under control, they realized that they had used up most of their fuel, so they had to come back early.
So we got to do an emergency deorbit.
That's correct.
A landing, as I recall, in the Pacific.
In the Pacific,
which was
right.
not the planned landing site. So we got to practice all kinds of things that we didn't want to practice.
Exactly.
On that, but it was the very first successful orbital mm-hmm. docking.
That's right.
So let's look at some of the images from Gemini, if I can get this thing to work. It's a two-person spacecraft, as we mentioned. It was launched by the Titan rocket.
That's correct.
Which had been a ballistic missile rocket. Adapted mm-hmm. for use with Gemini. And some of the things we did. Ed White
did the very first spacewalk for this country. He had a little handheld device that just used some compressed air and it moved him around a little bit. He didn't want to come back in. I think Jim McDivitt had to speak rather sternly to him to get him back in. And I think once he started coming back in, he had a hard time getting in because one of the things that nobody thought about was that once they had depressurized the spacecraft, his suit inflated to the point where it was very difficult for him to get back in. And as I remember, they had to use some extra means to get the hatch closed, like a rope that they had to pull down on to get the hatch closed because Jim had to stuff Ed into the seat because of this extra buoyancy in his suit.
But again, all of these things were things we had to learn how to do and
there
had to develop.
Things we had to know about, absolutely.
In order to go to the moon.
Yep.
Here's another image of what we did. The very first orbital rendezvous, where a Gemini capsule rendezvoused with another Gemini capsule.
Right.
It was Gemini 6A that joined up with Gemini 7.
Right, that's correct.
And flew in formation, followed up by, as we mentioned, I guess Gemini 8. Gemini, this is another picture of the first orbital rendezvous.
Right. See, when Gemini 8 and 9 came along, we'd been able to do the docking. We knew we could do the rendezvous. Docking was something that could also be done, but I think we needed a little more practice on that. But the latter flights really started concentrating on the spacewalk. And I think the last three flights all had spacewalks. And we found a lot of problems with that that were subsequently corrected so that the Apollo program could do their extravehicular activities rather trouble-free and stress-free.
Okay, very good. So anyway, a few more images from Gemini here. This was the Agena target, which was the first docking.
Let's see, Pete took the Agena up to 230 miles?
It was higher than that. On the last slide, it was 700.
I'm getting old. I forget all these things.
So it was a few years ago.
Yeah, it was a few years 700 ago.
700 and some miles is where they boosted the Agena and the Gemini up to, which was the farthest anyone had been from Earth at that point. And, of course, landing, you'd splash down in the ocean.
Right.
And after 11 Gemini missions, and these were some of the accomplishments. 739 miles was how high they had taken the Agena and the
I'll take your word for it.
And the Gemini. So that was quite some altitude. And then it was time to move on to Apollo.
Right.
And we had all these features, the Saturn V booster, the command module, the lunar module, all of those things to take us to the moon.
We had, the first flight was an S-1B. The short version of the Saturn launch vehicle, which was designed just to get a spacecraft and, the command service module into Earth orbit. That was on Apollo 7 with Wally Schrau, Walt Cunningham, and Don Eisley. That was after we had to fire at the Cape in 67, and it was like 2 years later before we could get that flight off. But all the changes that were made as a result of the fire were all excellent changes, and they, in my opinion, they made the rest of the program successful.
And let's see, I think I had a slide that talked a little bit about the Apollo fire. We lost Gus Grissom, Roger Chaffee, and Ed White in the Apollo launch pad fire. And turns out it was caused by 100% oxygen atmosphere at what, 21 PSI.
Well, see, they had to go 5 PSI over normal atmosphere, so they were up about 21 PSI, but there were some other things that happened, too. One is that basically they coated all the instrument panels with foam rubber so that they wouldn't hurt anything inside the spacecraft. So there was a lot of foam rubber inside the spacecraft, 21 PSI oxygen, and a spark, and that's all it took.
And a lot of things are flammable in a high oxygen concentration and a high pressure, things that we wouldn't normally think would be flammable. So we learned a very difficult lesson.
But we go back to what we said when we first started. It was a test program. You don't always get everything right the first time. It was sad to lose three guys. But what came out of that was a very safe spacecraft and one that flew successfully on every flight after that, except for 13, but that's kind of a different thing.
13 is kind of a different thing. Let's look at some of the images from Apollo. And I'm having to look way over here to see them. We talked about the fire. The launch history, we had, what was it, 12 Apollo flights?
Yeah, something like
that. It's on the list over there. Anyway, you can count them all yourself. We had a whole bunch of Apollo flights is what
yes.
we had. And here's the S-1B that Al mentioned
right.
as the rocket that launched Apollo 7.
That's correct.
Which was the first launch of an Apollo. And after that, leading up to the first moon landing.
After 7, Apollo 8 was supposed to fly the lunar module into Earth orbit for checkout. The lunar module slipped on its schedule, so they ended up sending Apollo 8 to the moon with Frank Borman and Jim Lovell and Bill Anders. And then Apollo 9, Jim McDivitt, Dave Scott, and Rusty Schweikert flew Earth orbital. And then Apollo 10 flew lunar orbital with the lunar module. And all of these things, everything was a little bit more difficult and required a little bit more precision than anything that had gone before. And by the time Apollo 10 finished its flight, everybody was pretty much ready for a landing on the moon, except that all of us down in Mission Control kept thinking that, you know, there's no way the very first flight out of the box is going to land. So we were all betting on Pete Conrad on 12. They overcame all their problems, and Neil landed on 11. So that was a very historic, and he's the right guy to do it.
And so here we are. This is the Apollo 11 crew that landed at first on the moon using the Saturn V booster, which is
That's
this picture.
Correct.
Used the Saturn V rocket. Glorious picture of it flying by the American flag mm-hmm. during the launch. And here is, let's see, what was it? Was it Spider and Gumdrop? What were the... Columbia.
Columbia. Yeah.
Columbia. Okay, Columbia on
yeah,
its way.
I'm forgetting all the... All, Eagle.
Eagle.
The Eagle's
Eagle.
Landed.
Okay, Eagle.
Eagle and Columbia.
And,
yeah.
and Columbia was
right.
the mothership.
Right.
The command module.
Now, it's kind of interesting because the sort of the direction that they were given, what they were told to do was land on the moon, get outside, walk around for a few minutes, get back in and come home. We didn't want to extend our liability out there too much. Apollo 12 took a big jump because Apollo 12 then had to land on a given spot on the moon where Apollo 11 was given a pretty big wide open field to land in. Apollo 12, Pete Conrad had to land next to the Surveyor, an unmanned spacecraft that was up there, and he landed close enough so that he and Al Bean could walk over to it and take some pieces off of it to bring back so they could study what happens to metal structures sitting on the moon for 3 years.
Okay, a couple images from the moon landing, and of course this was the lunar module on its way down to the
right.
landing, and of course the first footprint on the moon by Neil Armstrong, July the 20th, 1969, accomplishing
right.
the goal of being there before the decade was out.
We're coming up next year, next July, it'll be 40 years.
40 years since,
40 years
since
ago.
We've been
yeah.
there. A couple
it's
more
amazing.
Pictures. Pretty picture of Buzz Aldrin. Shot by Neil on the surface of the moon, and a view of just how large the lunar module was when everything got back down there to the surface.
Oh, yeah. It was kind of a spidery machine, but in lunar gravity, which is 1/6 what we have here on Earth, you could build something pretty lightweight to go down there. So it was about 35,000 pounds, I think, going down, and I'm not sure what the ascent stage weighed coming back up, but I think what was left in lunar orbit was about 2,500 pounds.
Quite a bit smaller.
Pretty
and
small.
here's a picture of the ascent stage when it came back up, if
there
I can
is.
Get... And this is what
That's
came
all
back
that's left.
Up from the moon.
Right.
That's all that left
yep.
When you come back up for the lunar rendezvous.
Exactly.
So let's see. How about... Now, here's what an Apollo is supposed to look like when it splashes down in the ocean. Three beautiful full parachutes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk about a really significant mission. This is the launch of Apollo 15. What was going on
okay.
on that? This was your mission, Al.
Yeah. Actually, Apollo 15 was quite different from anything that had flown before. We were, I think, the heaviest launch in the program. We were around 7 million pounds at launch. We had a thrust level of 7.5 million pounds getting us off the ground. But the reason we were so heavy is because we carried the first lunar rover, and we carried a scientific instrument package in the service module into lunar orbit, adding considerable to the weight of the launch vehicle. So basically, we had the heaviest launch. It took us 13 minutes to get to orbit. You guys in the shuttle take about 8.5. We went into an orbit of 90 miles because we didn't have enough energy to go any higher. You guys go into what, 130, 140, 150, 160, 160? Okay, in 8.5. So there's a big difference. It was a long ride getting into orbit. And in 90 miles, we could only go around the world about three times, as I recall, was the ground rule, because we were on the fringe of the atmosphere. And, Newton was still controlling what happened to us. So as we went around, we were decelerating all the time. And at the end of three revolutions, we probably would have had to come back home. As it turned out, we got everything done, and we got on our way just fine.
Okay, and let's see, a couple images from that. Here's our dauntless crew of Apollo 15.
Right.
Dave Scott, Al Warden,
and
Jim Irwin was the crew. And as Al mentioned, the lunar rover.
Right, a little electric car. That was apparently a joy to drive on the moon in 1/6 gravity. It was speed limited. I think its top speed was about 7 miles an hour. But they found out that if they drove it over about 4 miles an hour, half their time was flying, because if they hit a little rock, they'd be flying off the surface. So they had to be rather careful with it. But it got them around. In fact, they got about 17 kilometers of traverse distance on the surface of the moon. Whereas if they were just walking, they couldn't go anywhere near that far.
You couldn't get nearly that much accomplished.
Well, if no matter what, whether you're walking or riding, you could only get so far away from the lunar module as your emergency oxygen supply would keep you alive to get back. That was on the chest pack. So if you're walking, you got to stay pretty close. But if you're on a lunar rover, you can throw a few extra tanks on and go.
You could ride it back. Okay, now we looked before, at just a moment ago, at what a normal landing was supposed to look like. And this is Apollo 15 coming back down.
Right.
What were you guys thinking, Al?
I wasn't thinking
this
anything.
This doesn't look right.
At that point. Actually, what I was thinking, I was watching the other two chutes to make sure they were okay. It was a strange set of circumstances that caused us to lose that one parachute. A normal procedure, once you get on all three chutes coming down, the normal procedure was to purge all the RCS fuel out because it's hypergolic. And you don't want to hit something in the water that might mix that fuel and you got a little explosion on your hands. So the procedure was to purge all that stuff out, to blow it all out through the lines. Well, the atmospheric conditions were exactly right that day for that fuel to go out of the line and go straight up the risers into that one chute. And that hypergolic fuel, the minute it hit that nylon in the chute, just I could see big holes coming out in the chute. And just before we touched down, the second chute was starting to do the same thing. So I'm glad we landed when we did. It was a good thing.
Good move.
Yeah, it was a good move. Right.
All right. So anyway, we went on to, let's see, from there, Apollo 17, the last moon launch with Gene Cernan and company, launched at night, our first night
gorgeous
launch.
Gorgeous launch, by the way, that night launch. They were supposed to launch around 10 o'clock. They had a few problems. They finally got off the ground about midnight. And it was just a spectacular launch. A night launch is just something that, you got to see.
You really need to go see.
Absolutely.
Great.
Everybody needs to go to the Cape to watch any launch, but a night launch in particular is really spectacular.
So I have a whole list of Apollo accomplishments here. Obviously, landing on the moon. We had the successful abort of Apollo 13. Alan Shepard drove a golf ball, 200 to 400 feet?
Yards was the
estimate. He claims 200 to 400 yards, doesn't he?
30 yards.
30 yards.
Yeah.
Hey, I can do that.
He shanked it. Yeah. We actually saw the golf ball in a picture, but I think it's I think that particular picture's been destroyed.
Okay, so that's where Apollo took us. Next up was Skylab, and it was also known as Apollo Applications Program.
Right. We're really beginning to switch gears from long-distance flight, like lunar flights, into Earth orbital research flights, and Skylab was the start of that. So we had, what, three flights with Skylab, and we got some really long-term living in space with Skylab to get the, you know, the precursor to the International Space Station. I think the last crew stayed, what, 83 days?
84 days. 84 days. Yeah. Yes. And Skylab was based on the Saturn V launch vehicle.
That's correct. It was the last stage. In fact, it was the empty last stage.
Empty last stage. Okay, and let's see. What do we have? Here's the launch of Skylab.
Right.
And then we had three crews that went there. The very first crew had to repair the thing because we lost one of the solar arrays.
One of the solar panels didn't unfurl. So what they had to do is go out and do something to it to get it to open up. And that was Pete Conrad's flight, where he went out there. And in fact, if anybody was here in 94 when we had this little session, Pete described what happened to him when he tried to unfurl that solar panel. He got in the middle of it and was pulling on it, and all of a sudden it snapped open and threw him clear to the end of the tether. So he went tea kettle out, and you know, the tether stopped him. It's a good thing, because he might still be there.
Good thing we used tether.
Yeah.
So we had, as Al mentioned, we had three flights of Skylab and some very long-term stays, 28 days, 59 days, and 84 days to the end of the Skylab program. Okay, after that, another quick mission, Apollo Soyuz.
Apollo Soyuz was an interesting concept and an interesting mission. It was really designed to allow an American and a Russian spacecraft to dock in space to prove a rescue capability. But there were a lot of other factors involved, too, and I think it was the beginning of closer relationships with the Russians. I think it was politically a motivated thing.
Wasn't it a move as well to decrease some of the tensions of the Cold War to have an American and
Russian spaceship? Well, I think that was part of it. Yeah, I think that was part of it. Also, I think it was it may have been a flight that was added to the schedule so that Deke Slayton could fly. You never know. But if everybody knows, Deke Slayton was one of the original seven Mercury guys. He was taken off flight status because he had a little irregularity in his heartbeat. And when Apollo Soyuz came along, the doctors decided that it was okay as long as he went with someone. And, of course, he went with Tom Stafford, so that made it okay. So he actually got his flight. All the Mercury 7 guys got their flight.
Okay, and I think just a few images from Apollo Soyuz. This is the launch, which was another Saturn S-1B booster rocket. And this was the Russian rocket, Soyuz, which means Russian, which means union in Russian. Right. I am so good with Russian.
Yeah.
It means union in Russian. And here's the Soyuz spacecraft up in orbit before they docked. And then I guess they must not have had very good cameras back in 1975, because this is as good a photo as I've found of the handshake between Tom Stafford and Alexei Leonov.
Yeah. You know, one of the really, really great things that came out of Apollo Soyuz was Alexei Leonov, and he's still a really good friend, and he's very partial to us over here, and whenever he comes over, he really has a good time.
Well, yeah, Charlie and I got to meet him, and I think maybe the rest of you might have as
Absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, yeah.
And very, very,
he's a good guy.
Very personable general, Russian general.
We call him the Russian bear. He gives you a bear hug like you've never had.
Yeah, yeah. So very, very interesting guy. Okay, so anyway, to the end of Apollo, we had flown 31 launches, and then we decided we're going to move on to a reusable launch vehicle, and that would be the space shuttle. The studies began in the early 1970s after swarms and swarms of wind tunnel testing and everything else to prove the concept. We built the very first space shuttle, which was Enterprise. And Steve, what did we do with Enterprise?
Well,
I hope you know.
I remember Enterprise. I was not with NASA then. I was in the Air Force, and I was stationed at Edwards Air Force Base. So we got to be not participants but spectators and watch all these flights. But the purpose of the Enterprise was to be a gliding vehicle. They decided before they flew a shuttle into space, we wanted to drop one. to let it glide down to Earth and see what the final approach and landing characteristics of the shuttle were. So that's why Enterprise was built. And then I guess there's another whole story that goes with the selection of the 747 as the carrier aircraft. It was actually the launch aircraft. And I think there were a lot of bets on the first one of whether the Enterprise would clear the tail, but it cleared it by a country mile.
Well, and we now have up on the screen a picture of this concept of the Enterprise on board the 747. And who would have ever thought that this thing could actually fly that way?
That's
what,
right.
What was this? What speed did they have to, what velocity did they have to clear?
I don't know, but I know that the Enterprise was set at a higher incidence angle to the fuselage of the 747 than when we now just ferry orbiters. So it popped off the top with, like, I don't know, a G and a half or so. I mean, it had some acceleration, and it cleared the tail by a good margin. And with the tail cone on, in those pictures, they could climb to above 20,000 feet, I believe, for these tests. When they flew a couple of tail cone off flights to expose the dummy engines, there's more drag, and I don't think they made it to 20,000 feet even.
You must have known what the next slide was. There's the that we did two tail cone off flights, right? ALT 4 and 5, and culminating with a precision landing on flight 5 that led us into the first orbital space shuttle, which was Columbia. The first one we had ready to go was Columbia. And let's see, I don't know, Steve, talk about STS 1 and 2. I think you were there in a chase plane, weren't you?
We were. I was trying to remember, you and I are in the same group, and we came there in 1978, so we weren't in the early development of the shuttle. We came more at the late development stages, and I can remember working a lot of software issues, and there were we came in 78, didn't fly till 81. There were many issues centered around problems with the main engines, problems with the thermal tile sticking to the airplane, and also some problems with the general-purpose computers that run the shuttle, you know, running right in synchronization. And it's like by the spring of 1981, all this just kind of came together, and all those problems were being solved, and it was working well. So you and I both were on chase team, weren't we, for the first flight. I wound up kind of being in a backup role at El Paso. We used White Sands as a backup site. I think an abort once around site for the shuttle had an emergency and had to go once around the world and land. And also it was called the underburn site in case when they're coming into California, if they didn't get enough burn out of the engines to slow down, they could have overshot and wound up in some cases landing out there at White Sands. So that's where I was.
Yeah, very good. Now, I think, Linda, you were working for NASA then. I first met you when you were a payload officer. Weren't you a payload officer,
I was,
I'm thinking?
When I first got my first time, I interviewed to be in the astronaut program. I didn't get in that time, but they said, you can come down and work for us anyway. And I gladly took them up on that because I really wanted to be a part of the program. So, yeah, I did work in that area first, and I went to work there right before STS-1. And in fact, I got to go see that launch, and so that was pretty
when good. When did you first join NASA, Linda? I don't remember.
1980.
And
then, but the
astronaut
program for me was 85 then.
Okay, so we had, and then we selected Linda in 1985
right.
With the 1985 class as an astronaut. Okay, but the first couple of shuttle flights, we had STS-1 that launched with a white tank, as mm-hmm. well as STS-2 launched with a white external tank. Columbia went up for 2 days on the first flight, STS-1, April 12th to April the 14th. Came gliding back down and landed, thereby being the very first winged spacecraft to go to space and the world's fastest flying airplane, Mach 25, during the reentry. So a pretty exciting vehicle to fly. From there, it was... this thing is kind of a low-tech button I've got here.
We can go to the moon easy.
Yeah, we can go to the moon.
Okay, compared to all this
back
technology.
It up one. Well, now I can't get it. Can you back it up two? Back it up two, please. This button is not working very well. Off we went. We did all kinds of things now that we had a reusable launch vehicle going to space, and we had more people going to space. We would fly 7 people at a time in the space shuttles, and we started doing more spacewalks. Linda, you got to do how many spacewalks?
I got to do 2. I mean, obviously, some people have done many, many walks. I got to do 1 when we were docked to Mir, 1 when we were docked to the International Space Station. So that was pretty neat to get out and climb on 2 different space structures like that and and have that experience and look at the Earth.
Linda has had quite a great experience getting to do docking flights with the Russian space station Mir. Mir means world and peace in Russian. I am such a whiz with Russian. And as well,
I'm really impressed.
As the international, yeah, I'm not very good with English, but and as well, Linda got to go to the International Space Station as well. So the sorts of things we did were spacewalks. Next one, please. Untethered spacewalks. We flew people, as you can see, great distances away from the shuttle. We got into the satellite repair business. Next one. This was the repair of the Solar Max satellite. You remember that one, Steve?
Yeah.
This was on 41C, which I guess was our 13th launch.
Yeah, that was one of Crippen's flights. And that satellite they were going to retrieve with a manned maneuvering unit, right? Pinky Nelson flew out to that and kept bouncing off the satellite and couldn't latch to it. They found out later, this is where the devil's in the details, you know, they designed this latch mechanism to grab onto, I think, a trunnion on this satellite, but there was a little standoff bracket that held a thermal blanket, if I'm recalling correctly, out a little too far, didn't allow him to get close enough with that mechanism to grab it. It's just like a fraction of an inch. So his attempts, it was through no fault of his own, got that satellite to wobbling, so they flew away from it and came back, I think, a day later. And by that time, the ground had sent commands to take some of this wobble out, but the satellite was still rotating slowly, and they let Terry Hart, who's another one of our classmates, grab it with the arm. They flew up close to it, and the satellite rotated by. He just grabbed it with a remote arm, and they snared it. So it was a great mission.
Great mission.
And they learned a lot from that.
Pulled it into the cargo bay and repaired the, I think it had gyros that were bad and maybe batteries that were bad. I don't remember all the things that were broken, but they totally repaired that satellite and returned it to space. The next one, we got into the satellite repair business, and one of the crews made up this funny sign that says satellites for sale after they had retrieved these two satellites, brought them back down to Earth, and they made it back to space a couple of years later on other booster rockets. So we got into some pretty exciting things in the course of the first 25 shuttle flights. And then we lost the Challenger. January the 28th, 1986, you probably all know, we lifted off mission called 51L Challenger on the 25th space shuttle launch. And at the left-hand side of the white booster rocket, you can see the little puff of smoke coming out of it. I think the next slide is a little bit later. Once they got up into the sky, the booster rocket burned through, eventually burned a hole in the tank, and the vehicle was destroyed, and we lost all seven of the astronauts. Next one. And an image, I think, that's burned into all of our memories. All of us can remember exactly where we were when we saw Challenger, as well as Columbia later on. But the recovery from Challenger took us, nearly 3 years, Steve, is what it took us. And you were down at the Cape after the accident as part of the recovery team, as I recall.
Yeah, several of us went down to Florida and worked for the first couple of weeks on the recovery of debris. It was a bad time, obviously, for everybody. In my own mind, about 6 months after that accident is when I think as a group, maybe as an agency, NASA kind of turned the corner from grieving about the loss to looking forward to flying the shuttle again. And President Reagan has said we'd build another orbiter, so we built Endeavour, a couple years later. And it may sound strange, but I found that period of my life to be one of the most fulfilling from about 6 months after the accident until we started flying again, working on the kinds of things where we really felt we were contributing to getting the shuttle going again.
And we found a number of problems, not just in the booster rocket. Certainly the booster rocket was the largest single problem. But we made major repairs to a great many areas, part of it being our management system, part of it being our commit-to-flight process. So it was a very traumatic time for NASA, but it was something that we emerged from, I think, a great deal stronger, don't you think, Steve, after that was all over?
Oh, I do. I think NASA came out stronger. The shuttle came out a lot safer after that. Obviously, there's always risk involved, but for a long period of time, and the evidence is the long string of flights we had through the 1990s, where we kind of hit a pace of about five or six or seven flights per year, just held that pace right on through the 1990s till we started building Space Station.
So it was almost 3 years. September of 1988, after the Challenger accident of January 1986, and we finally returned to flight with Discovery, and let's rattle through some of our slides there. And we did some more spectacular things. We launched the Hubble Space Telescope. Our good friend Steve Hawley worked the arm to move the thing out of the cargo bay. Hubble had some problems, as we all know. It had, what was it, nearsighted or short-sighted or something?
That had astigmatism.
That's right, it was. It was astigmatism. Yeah, that's right. Hubble had astigmatism. We launched a brilliant flight up there to repair the Hubble Space Telescope, fix the astigmatism, and we have sent a number of flights up to it since then to update and to maintain the Hubble Space Telescope.
Going to do it again.
And some of the science products that we have received from Hubble have just been spectacular, such as this picture of the... this is called the Black Eye Galaxy, and it's two galaxies colliding, and these are the sorts of images that Hubble has been returning to us routinely. Next one. We also had the very first three-person spacewalk, which was a repair that was not going well up in orbit using just two people, and so we put three people out there to manhandle this, 21,000-pound satellite. To recover it, retrieve it, fix it, and drop that satellite back off. And we added a drag chute. I think you have, Charlie, you've flown with the drag chute, haven't you?
Absolutely. It puts a lot of savings into the wear and tear of the brakes and the wheels on the orbiter, and it gets you stopped in a hurry when you need to. It's a wonderful addition, obviously, to capability.
One of the old NASA engineers told me that the shuttle was originally designed to have a drag chute, and it was removed as a weight saving and a cost saving. And so then, 20 years later, we added the drag chute back on. But as Charlie says, it has been a wonderful thing for reliability.
And as things are in engineering, it's not that easy just put a chute on there. Recall how difficult the procedure was. You had to pop the chute at exactly the right moment when you were lowering the nose to make it work effectively and to make it work correctly for us, so we didn't slam that nose down too hard when we landed.
Okay, so moving on, we sent a number of flights to the Mir space station. STS-63 did a close approach in early 1995. And then, Charlie, you were on the first docking mission to the Russian Mir space station, STS-71. Say just
I think you were on that mission, too, weren't
well,
you, Hoot?
I might have been there, too, but I'm talking too much, so...
Hoot and I had the distinct pleasure of being the first to dock with the Russians since 20 years before when Apollo-Soyuz took place. And it was a really interesting development. Steve was part of actually bringing a lot of the hardware into the fold to be able to dock the shuttle. Recall, we had to put a docking mechanism into the payload bay. It turns out that part of that hardware that we actually loaded into the shuttle came from Russia because we had to connect to a Russian space station. And history says that in Apollo-Soyuz, an engineer, a young engineer at the time by the name of Seremyatnikov, if you remember him, designed
Vladimir Seremyatnikov
designed the docking mechanism. We used to call it a Swiss watch, but it worked very, very reliably. That same mechanism survived through all of those years to be found on the shuttle for all of the shuttle Mir dockings that we did. And Hoot and I took that flight up in June of 1995, and we traded Russian and American crew members on the Mir. Norm Thagard had been up there for 100 days. And one of the biggest things I recall was all of the missions on shuttle in those years prior to docking. All of us as crew members got to do a lot of medical experiments, but suddenly none of us on our crew Hoot were of interest because Norm was in space for 100 days on the Mir, and all of the science was done on his duration in space, the effects of being there for so long.
So they didn't hardly care about our 10 days.
We got to fly.
We got to fly, and we got done at 10 days, and here was Norm with 100 days. So,
exactly.
So test him to death, not us.
That's exactly right.
So that worked out great. So let's see. I think we probably have some more Mir slides. This was a slide of the first Mir docking just before Atlantis undocked to leave after 5 days of being docked.
And you recall we had three spacecraft in close proximity to each other. The two Russian crew got in their Soyuz, and they undocked from the Mir and went out to the side to film us undocking from the shuttle. There was no one on board the Mir. It was under control of the autopilot, which failed while they were undocked, if you recall. And the Mir started a slow gyration, while we were doing this filming, and the Soyuz crew had to do an expedited redocking, just barely making it to the docking port before it went dark. So it was a pretty exciting moment there for us while we were getting those pictures.
So instead of just two spacecraft needing to not run into each other at 17,000 miles an hour, we had three of them that had, had to avoid. Somehow we never did that again. It's the only time that was ever done. All right, next one. And then we started with International Space Station. And Linda has been there. And Charlie, I don't remember. Did you go?
No, of mine were the three times to Mir, and then we launched the first flight of the space station right after my last flight.
Okay, and this was the view that we had as we were doing the first assembly flight with the space shuttle approaching the Zarya module. And I guess, Linda, you were there when that was going on. That was Bob Cabana, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was there. I mean, it was pretty exciting to see us finally start to put this thing together in space. You know, we'd had some crews assigned quite a while working on, you know, a whole slew of missions that we're going to have to follow in a very critical order. And to finally see Bob get off with that one to start it rolling was great. You know, we used to say the Hubble telescope was the most challenging missions we did on the shuttle. And then once we started putting station together, they all became like that or more. So, I mean, every flight was that kind of challenge, particularly that had the major structural pieces.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Oh, and over the course of the years, we built the space station up to where we built this magnificent structure, and it's taken, I don't remember, what is it, 24 shuttle flights or some number similar to that.
Yeah.
And Linda, you've gone EVA on both the spacewalk. On both the Mir space station and the International Space Station. What sort of things were you doing when you went on your spacewalk, say on the International Space Station?
Okay, on the International Space Station, we were... first of all, we went up there to exchange a crew out. We took up three new guys and brought back the ones that had been up there, so we didn't have a major element. But they'd been having problems with one of the beta gimbal assemblies that rotated the solar array, and then they'd been having some thermal issues. You know, as you go around the world every 90 minutes, you're roughly half daylight and half sunlight, so you have these major thermal excursions that all the hardware has to survive. So somehow they were having problems with that. So we went up to put something on it, kind of like a drink koozie, you know, that just to try to average out those thermal limits that it saw. So we got to climb all the way out. We got part of the ride on the end of the remote arm, and then we had to get off and go to the end of the truss and put this blanket on it. And on the way there and back, we did some get-ahead tasks, which is what we call where we're trying to do something for future spacewalks to have a little bit of a head start for them. We try to do some things in place for that. So, you're very busy when you go out the hatch. You're kind of hoping you don't screw up because lots of people are watching and you've trained and trained for it. And I know our commander, we were going over Houston on one of the orbits, and he said, hey, you need to stop and just look at this. And I swear, you know, you almost take somebody telling you to slow down, you know, just remember you've got a great view out there and take time and enjoy it. And that's one of the things I remember about that spacewalk.
And the number and duration of spacewalks that we have done since International Space Station came around has dramatically increased from any of our prior history before. Can you put some rough numbers to that, Linda?
You know, I'm searching for a number, but the word exponential just kind of comes to mind. I don't have it on the tip of my tongue. Every flight, it seems like, has three or four, and we used to go many missions with zero. So, I mean, it's just, there's no comparison. When we were on STS-37, we had two of our crew members go out and do a spacewalk, and it was the first one in how many years?
Well, about 5.5 years.
So we went five and a half years with none, and then all of a sudden we're doing three or four missions with several flights a year. So.
And you remember you talked about the first shuttle flight was 2 days. The last one was 16, I think it was, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And 10 of them were docked. It was literally twice the length of the mission you and I did, the first docking to the Mir station. So the productivity and the workload is dramatically increasing.
So we have gone on to do some very dramatic things with the International Space Station. And then, next one, not without incident. We had Columbia, February the 1st of 2003, and as we all know, we lost the space shuttle Columbia during the reentry. And I don't know, Charlie, you weren't still there then, but I guess Steve, you were in safety at the time.
C-
Can you talk a little bit about what happened there?
Well, I was in aviation by that time at aircraft operations, so I wasn't really that close to the shuttle program. But again, you know, I think from Challenger, you saw this huge increase in budget and safety on the shuttle. And then there was a gradual, looking back on it, there was a gradual decline over the years. This is a lesson to be learned not just by the space program, but by all of aviation and just life in general, where an accident really piques your attention to detail and worrying about things going wrong. And not that we were careless with the shuttle, but I think a lot of us had seen foam coming off the tank for years. I mean, I remember on launches seeing little divots of foam pop out, come back, hit the windscreen, and go over, you know, about the size of a piece of popcorn. It doesn't hurt anything. So I think a lot of us were sensitized, saying, well, the foam off the tank doesn't really hurt anything. And then we'd see, you had some flights, I know, with a lot of damage to the tile from various debris coming off. And we got this mindset, well, the tile is fragile, but yet it's robust enough that you can take some hits and it's okay. And I think a lot of us thought the leading edge of the wings were pretty darn tough. And in fact, they're brittle, and they're not that tough. And so we all kind of, in our minds, were led down the rosy path, I believe, of allowing this mindset to continue.
I agree. Those wing leading edges, I always thought they were cast iron. They're heavy, they're thick, and I thought they were cast iron. And then we came to find out when we got hit by debris with STS-107's launch on Columbia, they're really eggshells is more what they're like.
Brittle, right?
They're very brittle. Yes, they're very brittle. And so, of course, the next slide, the launch of STS-107 was January the 16th of 2003, and then they were up, I think, a 16-day mission.
It was. It was a Space Lab mission. It was a unique mission among the ones we were doing. It wasn't a typical space station assembly. They were in a completely different orbit doing a standalone module science experiments within their payload bay, and it was very unique among the flights of the time. So, but it was 16 days.
I was at Capcom on that flight, and which I really feel, in hindsight, I feel very privileged. I got to work with them on that mission, and they just, like Charlie was saying, they worked their hearts out for science on that flight because they were 24-hour ops, and a lot of that data made it down during the mission because they transmitted it down. And then incredibly, you know, where the debris was spread over East Texas, they retrieved really unusual things that made it all the way down to the ground, and some of it was the science data. And the one unique thing for NASA there was that we just had a tremendous support from the people that lived in East Texas, the hordes of volunteers that spent hours combing the land out there to find all the pieces that then were taken to Florida. So that was really an amazing experience.
You know, I was thinking, Hoot, for the folks that are here that do a lot of designing and building of aircraft, that one of the major lessons that came out of both Challenger and Columbia is something I call collateral damage. When you look at Challenger, the solid rocket motor was the cause, but the effect was on the external tank. The tank is what failed, so the collateral damage of a failure on the booster was really the effect. The solid rocket booster, as you recall, kept flying afterwards. And then on Columbia, it was similar, right? The foam coming off the tank hit the wing. The tank didn't care. Tank made the rest of its mission, made it into orbit. What failed was the wing. So this collateral damage concept in the design is something that I think you're going to talk about here in a little bit, is where we're going next with the future designs. We're learning enough out of all of this experience to be able to bolster our reliability and safety for the future of spaceflight.
And they have been difficult lessons. And the next slide, of course, shows an image of Columbia during the reentry. And we can see in this picture that the left-hand wing does not look normal. This was an infrared image. And what was happening was that there had been a hole knocked in the leading edge of the wing. The hot plasma, the hot gas during reentry got inside the wing. And the next slide is an image that all of us are too familiar with, of course, the breakup of Columbia. It took us quite a while, but once again, we recovered. And the next launch was STS-114, commanded by our first female mission commander, Eileen Collins, who's a veteran of four space shuttle flights, two as the mission pilot, two missions as the mission commander, and we have, two other female mission commanders, one of whom has flown, and I guess another one who's getting ready to, as I recall.
Pam has commanded a flight now, and Pam Milroy, and then we had Susan K. Kilrain, who flew twice.
And so, we got to see some more beautiful images. The next slide is some of the maneuvers that we started doing when we would take the shuttle to the International Space Station, so we could look it over very carefully for tile damage, leading edge damage, and all of those sorts of things. So this is one of the images. The next one is an image of the bottom side of the orbiter, looking at all the tiles to make sure that we're safe for reentry. The next slide moves on to the next phase, and I think Linda is the one who's the closest to this. So maybe, Linda, three slides remaining, so maybe you'd say a word or two about where we're going from here.
One thing, I guess, to follow up on 107 when we lost it, when we recovered from that and came back to flight, that's the first time we had a deadline to retire the shuttle. That really came out after that event, that we will retire the shuttle by 2010, assuming we get all of our flights flown to finish what we need to do on the space station. And then we had a vision announced shortly thereafter that we will return to the moon, which who can believe it would take this long to get back to it, and then go on to explore in the solar system, you know, with some hope of getting people on Mars in the future, too. So we're working on a follow-on vehicle. It's been named Orion. So you had Apollo, now we have Orion. And a lot of people do say, we were talking behind the stage, and I was saying, now we're back. We're back to Apollo.
Say
anything?
My opinion, we're getting smart. Not that I'm prejudiced or anything, but Apollo was a great program, very successful. And Orion's going to be big brother to Apollo, basically. But, you know, there's one thing about all of this, and that is, in my opinion, it's a lot easier to go to the moon and back than it is to fly in Earth orbit. Because once you get away from Earth, a lot of things become pretty simple. Your trajectory is pretty well ordained. If something goes wrong, you have all kinds of ways of getting back on your trajectory. If all fails, you know, we carried one computer that had 75K of memory. We had one gyro. And you guys carried how many? Three?
A lot.
And how many computers did you carry? See, you had everything going for you. You had toilets. You had beds. You had indoor plumbing. You had all this kind of stuff. We didn't have any of that. Let me tell you.
Back in the brown shoe days.
My grandmother was a pioneer. She didn't have any of that. And I felt like I was going backwards when I went on Apollo because we didn't have any of that either. But I think I think it's wonderful that, and I think it's a smart thing to go back to a spacecraft that is like Apollo. It's going to be a little different, but it's going to fly basically the same way as Apollo. It's going to have a much more extended mission than we had. We're talking 6 months instead of 2 weeks. But that shape and that configuration and the way it's set up inside, it has a one-piece heat shield. Which is almost indestructible. I think it has a lot of things going for it. The shuttle is a wonderful machine. Technologically, it's the greatest thing in the world. Unfortunately, it's also kind of a fragile machine in certain respects. And I think Orion, we're going to see a more Apollo-like robustness in the spacecraft than we've had in the shuttle.
And speaking of that spacecraft, the next slide is an image of a big Apollo capsule, which is what...
Yeah, it's going to be, what is it, Linda? You probably know the numbers, but it seems to me like it's about 3 feet wider, 3 feet greater in diameter than Apollo.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think it's 5 meters in diameter, so it is larger.
I think it's 15 feet, isn't it?
Yeah, that'd be about.
We had 12. You know, the problem with 12 is you don't have 12 feet inside. Mm-hmm. You're talking 12 feet outside. So we were packed in like sardines on launch. We had to overlap shoulders because we didn't have enough width to all lay down side by side. Orion will probably get packed in a little bit. I mean, we're always very optimistic about these things when we start, but when we get to the final, countdown, we always try to put 5 pounds into a 2-pound bag, and Orion will probably be the same way.
It's the same. We're having a lot of challenges with mass. It's tough to go to the moon. I think I know I saw something. If you have 1 kilogram in Earth orbit, that you want to get all the way to the lunar surface and back, there's 19 additional kilograms you have to launch to do that. So going to the moon with a little larger vehicle is even that much more challenging, but we're going to take four people, and we have and the whole architecture has to support an eventual build-up to long-duration stays on the lunar surface. So we're going back with some different intentions this time, and it will also be capable of going to the International Space Station, which we'll do first.
So it has been quite a 50 years. It looks like a very dramatic future. Any final thoughts, Charlie?
I think for the next generation, to take away the lessons of what has been talked about here tonight, is there going to be a very promising future for us all in space. I think it's going to be extremely exciting. The promise of Apollo and the lessons from Shuttle. We're just going to have a great future in taking the program onto the moon and beyond.
Linda, any final final thoughts?
I think you have to send people into space because that's just the exploration. The way people explore, it's humanity's challenge, it's the way we've done things. And when I was a kid, I dreamed of getting to do that, and I'm fortunate that I did. But really, it's everybody's space program out there because they fund it, they support it, it belongs to the country. And I want to see our country in this new world now of many countries getting into space. I want our country to be there too. I want us to be at the forefront and be a leader. And that's what I see us doing in the future.
Very good. And it is a very important message that it isn't just boys that get to be astronauts. We have lots of women, and we're encouraging women in scientific professions and women in astronauts as well. Steve, any wrap-up thoughts?
I've always said I'd never trade places with anybody, but I would trade my four shuttle missions for one trip to the moon. But I was telling Al, I'd never met Al before tonight. I just want to thank him for coming here because I can't imagine doing a program like this without a person like yourself here. And I was telling him that people inspire other people, and you don't know all the time when you're doing it, because in 1971, I was a lieutenant in the Air Force, and I was stopping by Colorado Springs to see my sister before I went overseas to Thailand, and these guys had flown and were doing an appearance at the Air Force Academy, and I went out and saw them, and I already wanted to be an astronaut, but that one really charged me up, and you're a great inspiration to me, so I think I'm excited about the future. I'm excited about the Orion program going back to the moon. I think it's going to be great.
I have to make a comment, Steve. Almost every time I talk to somebody about when I made my flight, they say, "Oh, I remember that. I was 10 years old." And so it goes on, right? Well, I'm proud to be the old guy here tonight, I got to tell you. My only comment about the future, I believe this country can build anything to go anywhere that it wants to. Technologically, we can do just about anything we want. We got to have the support of the people to do that, and that's how it's going to get done. I think technologically we can do anything that we want to do. I think the human side of the equation needs a lot of work because we don't know what a two-year flight's going to do to us. So I think, and I know there's a lot of work going on in that, but I think that if we go to Mars or when we go to Mars, we got a lot of work to do. But technically, we can do it tomorrow.
Well, and I think the future looks bright. Al, Steve, Linda, Charlie, thank you very much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.